Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. If you live or work in San Francisco, chances are you have received mail from our guest tonight, Jose Cisneros, the treasurer and tax collector for the city and county of San Francisco. Cisneros oversees over $5.2 billion in revenue for the city and county. But did you know the treasurer's office also has a division devoted to financial equity issues? Or that it administers the city-sponsored and funded savings account that every San Francisco public student receives to use for higher education? Anti-poverty and financial empowerment are not movements you associate with a city tax collector, but Treasurer Cisneros does not think the work of his office stops with monitoring and collecting revenue. His willingness to address poverty issues and the problems facing low-income families are one reason that in 2013, Governing Magazine named him Public Official of the Year. As he will tell us tonight, Treasurer Cisneros is more than a tax collector. Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And of course, we hope you will join us in conversation with Treasurer Cisneros. We open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, but I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Or you can reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. So, Treasurer Cisneros, as we were talking before we started the program, I think I'm not the only one who might not completely understand what your day-to-day charge is.
What can I help you with? What do you need help understanding?
As treasurer and tax collector.
Sure.
Tell us, split those two and take one at a time.
Sure, absolutely. I'm glad, first of all, to be here. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about what we do in the treasurer's office. You have hit the nail on the head. The two primary responsibilities are treasurer and tax collector. The tax collector part of it is probably the bigger job, so let me start with that. We collect 181 different taxes and fees for the city and county of San Francisco. We bring in the largest share of the city's annual revenue. This year, we're on track to bring in about $5.2 billion from all those different types of taxes and fees. It's, you know, obviously, that makes it very important work, but it's not that visible all the time. But those billions of dollars pay for all the incredible services we all enjoy as people who live here in San Francisco, work here in San Francisco, visit here in San Francisco. Those billions of dollars pay for everything out there, the buses, the police, the fire, the hospitals, you name it, all of that. It's clearly very important work. We take it very seriously. Most of the taxes and fees we collect are actually paid by businesses. So we spend a lot of our time engaging with making sure that number one, we're enforcing them fairly. Everyone's paying their fair share. We firmly believe that's important. Because if one business, for example, got away without paying what they owe in taxes, they'd actually have an unfair economic advantage over maybe a very similar business sitting right next door, but who's following the law. Now, that doesn't sound fair to anybody, I don't think. And so we want to make sure that everyone's being treated equally, paying equally, and we're doing enforcement broadly and evenly across the board. We honestly try to make sure we deliver good customer service. It might come as a surprise for people to think the tax collector is worried about our customer service, but we honestly are, because what is absolutely true is that the easier it is for people to work with us, to understand what they owe, to comply with what they're obligated to do and to pay, it makes for higher degree of compliance, faster payments coming in. What I'm excited about is in the time that I've been in office, we have moved nearly everything online. So no more paper forms, no more showing up in person in our office. Almost everything any taxpayer does with us, they can entirely do online. They can file anything they need to file online. They can even pay online. They can do it at their own convenience, on their own schedule, and whatever method works for them. We really work hard. And because of that, we've seen our compliance and on-time payment rates continue to grow and grow and grow. The largest tax we collect is actually the property tax, which is paid both by businesses and individuals. And for every year, our on-time payment of property taxes is in the 98-99% of all that we collect. And that benefits everybody. Number one, it helps people avoid paying these outrageous late fees. I'd rather people not have to pay those. And two, it brings in the money when the city needs it, and then we have it available to provide the city services. We're continuing to upgrade our systems and make sure we're delivering the best possible opportunities for people to work with us and understand how they can comply with the tax laws. We actually, the voters voted in about 5-6 years ago, a sizable change to the way the business taxes, the largest business taxes work in this city. They switched from a company's business tax being entirely based on just a percentage of its payroll to a calculation based on a company's gross receipts. In the process of doing that, it made our business tax way more complicated. But I'm proud to say that, you know, we haven't been reading about tax revolt articles in the newspaper or anything like that. And I credit that to the staff in our office who really reached out and did everything we could to explain, to make sure people understand, to give businesses fair warning, to help them through the process of filing, even understanding how the law applies to them. And as a result, it's actually been quite a smooth transition, and I'm very happy and pleased that we've been able to do that. So the tax collection side is it occupies the work of the majority of the 200 people in our office. But the other role of treasurer is a very important one. Yes.
Before you go there, I wanted to ask you, so you're not the person who actually generates the bills. That's the assessor, correct?
For the property tax, yes, you are correct. The value of each property is set by the assessor's office, and that staff each year, when they finish up that year's assessment activities, sends over, well, to us and the controller's office, what they call the roll. The roll is the official term for the list of every single real estate property in the city and county of San Francisco, and actually business personal property, too, which also falls under property taxes in the state of California. They send that to us. And then we create the bills and send them out. But that assessed value is just then multiplied by the same tax rate that everybody pays on property taxes, but generates the amount owed on the bill.
So it's up to you and your staff to really be able to understand the intricacies of those 181 taxes and fees and make sure they're being applied correctly.
Absolutely. And not only that, but a lot of those different taxes and fees, like I said, are paid by businesses. And let me give you an example of how we really found it important to listen to what businesses were telling us and do whatever we could to support making things easier for them. We have no authority to change the amount of a tax. We can't forgive anybody's taxes or anything like that. But what we were finding was a lot of businesses told us that they had all these different taxes and fees that they owed to the city. Think about it. Maybe a person, a small restaurant, they owe a fee each year because the fire department comes out and inspects the smoke detectors and the fire suppression equipment. They have another fee that's they owe to the health department because the health department comes out and makes sure that their kitchen is sanitary and that their food is safe. Another one is owed to Public Works or whoever's monitoring the dining on the sidewalk and the outdoor facilities. DPW, the planning department, whoever, looking at additions, changes, all this stuff. So what we were hearing from businesses was, and the bills the city was sending, which, by the way, come from our office, were coming at all staggered, all spread out across the year. And they say, I just, you know, five bills have already been paid by me this year. What's coming next? When will I know if I'm ever done paying the city of San Francisco what I owe as a business? So we actually worked with a dozen or more city departments. We consolidated all those charges onto one annual bill, now send that to businesses. They pay it in March, and then they know they're done. And they can plan accordingly. They can be more successful. They can understand, okay, I've paid it for this year. Now I can plan for next year.
So you've facilitated the payment process. Obviously, you don't have anything to do with the designation of where those funds go or the fact that those taxes get assessed in the first place, right?
Correct. All the tax laws and fees are created by, you know, the policymakers, the mayor and the board of supervisors. Actually, now, given a number of laws in California, any new taxes have to be voted in by the voters. So we have no authority to create new, increase, change, reduce, change taxes in any way. We're just the folks administering and implementing them.
Okay. So let's move to the other side of your job, which is treasurer.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
So once the city brings in all this revenue, and by the way, in addition to all the money we collect, the money it gets from other places, state funds coming in from there, federal funds coming in from here, who knows, whatever else, to basically fund the $12 billion annual budget that the city and county of San Francisco has. When that money comes in, it's our responsibility to take all that money and invest it and keep it safe. We invest almost all the money for the city and county of San Francisco. The only monies we don't handle for the city and county are the long-term funds, which are the monies in the city's pension retirement board system. That is money that's going to stay around for many years, maybe even decades. Mm-hmm. Investing long-term money is very, very different than investing short-term money. We handle all the short-term money. The money we bring in is money that comes from the taxes, the fees, all sorts of other places. It might sit around for a few days, a few weeks, even a few months, and then it goes out again to pay salaries, to buy fuel for buses, to do all those things that the city's doing. It's not that different from the money, you know, you and I have in our checking accounts. Our paychecks come in, then they go out to pay rent, expenses, mortgage, whatever. It's that type of thing. The number one focus with any short-term money for the city, and frankly for you and me for that matter, is number one, safety of those funds. We would never buy stocks with that money because stocks could go down. And we need to have every dollar of that money that's sitting there. So we can only invest in the very safest opportunities to invest in. That's largely things like treasury bills, federal government guaranteed types of investments, things that are never, ever, ever going to be at risk. That's where the majority of our money goes. This money, as I mentioned, is constantly moving in and going back out. We're always managing kind of a moving balance. But lately, our average daily balance in that portfolio is around $12 billion, very similar to the size of the city's annual budget.
Yeah. And is that where, let's say, rainy day funds would sit with you, or is that a longer term investment?
You're correct. That anything that the city's doing outside of its pension management of funds is money that stays in our pool. And it might stay there for, like I said, a few weeks, a few months, or sometimes even a few years. Say the airport or the Public Utilities Commission, they go to the voters approve a bond to, say, improve the water pipeline system from Hetch Hetchy or to build a new terminal at the airport. Well, these are major capital projects, you know, in the hundreds of millions of dollars. When they get that approved, they go out to the market, they sell those bonds. All of a sudden, all that money floods in. They put it in our portfolio, those hundreds of millions of dollars, and then they gradually draw it down as that project is unrolling.
Hmm. How transparent is where you invest the money? Can people go online and see where you've invested the revenues of the city?
We're the government, so everything we do is absolutely transparent. Yes, we put out a monthly investment report that down to the dollar absolutely lists out where every single investment is being held, as well the amount, when we purchased it, when it's going to mature. Many of them are overnight, some are longer, and all that type of thing. So yes, everything we have is perfectly clear and available.
And so it sounds like you're mostly investing in bonds. So there wouldn't be any, say, concerns about investing in companies or other entities that may have different politics, for example, than the city.
Well, we do have a screen that we include in our investing that we call socially responsible investing. We invoke that whenever we can, but let me give you a little background. There are state laws that very clearly govern how we manage taxpayer funds for our county and every county in the state of California. There's a reason those laws are there. About 20-some years ago, the treasurer, person in my seat for the county of Orange County, California, was investing the money in risky investments, and they miscalculated and they lost millions of dollars of the county money. So much did they lose that the county had to declare bankruptcy. Well, certainly that was horrible and alarming. And as a follow-on to that, the state lawmakers set down clear legal laws that tell us how we have to manage the funds. And they put three priority orders out there, which are, first, safety. The funds have to be as safe as they possibly can be. Second, liquidity, which just means that we can't invest the money for longer than we might need to have it invested in case we need it. If we need it in a month, you don't invest it for 6 months. You need to have it in a month when you make sure you only invest it for shorter than when you need it again. And third, and only third, yield. Try and make some return on the investment. But yield never is set higher than liquidity or certainly safety, and that's how we manage to it. Now, once those criteria are met, we do have a screen where we look at, you know, if we have two choices that are equal under those three criteria, you know, how does it line up with our socially responsible investing criteria? We have some outside sources that give us information on how different companies are working with that. We don't have a lot of our money tied up in kind of like corporate paper, so to speak. You know, a lot of the best corporations will offer overnight funds and commercial paper or even slightly longer. But we make sure we're putting them through a socially responsible screen so we're not going outside of what I think everyone in San Francisco would be comfortable with.
And is that screen or those criteria also available for taxpayers to look at to see exactly what criteria you're using?
They certainly could request it. I don't know if it's in the monthly report that I was referring to, but anybody could call our office and request it. Sure.
Okay.
There's a public record request process that anybody can use.
So I wanted to pivot a little bit. This is about, you know, you talked about how the money is invested to be able to be there when it's needed for the city. But where exactly does the money sit? Does it sit in a city bank? There isn't a city bank, right? So, well, there is city bank, but there's not a city bank.
Correct.
So where actually does it sit?
So the majority of the $12 billion is invested in investments. So we work with brokers. We work with traders. We're not buying, as I said, actual stocks. Mm-hmm. What we are buying is T-bills, treasury bills, for example. You still do that through a broker. The same person that you might buy a stock through is the same person that sells you a treasury bill. So we're buying that. We're buying other federally guaranteed investments. Usually that's like paper issued by, say, Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, which comes with a full faith and guarantee of the federal government. For a short list of private companies, we might buy their commercial paper. We actually have our own in-house credit committee. We review and make sure that they're solid enough and safe enough that we can put monies with them, oftentimes for a short amount of time, but then we would maybe invest in their commercial paper or some of their types of offerings. So once you buy treasury bills or things like that, a custodian out there will hold it for us, but it's actually, they belong to us, no matter who's holding it for us. So where is our money sitting? It's actually sitting in those treasury bills, those commercial paper purchases that are guaranteed by the federal government, or maybe some highly qualified ones. We can, the state law does allow us to put monies into financial institutions, but they have to be very highly ranked so that they're extremely safe. We don't want to run any risk of a bank going out of business, defaulting, and losing our money. And there's another rule that says if we put our money into a financial institution as like a deposit, they have to collateralize our deposit. They have to create another pile of money actually larger than the amount of money we put with them and keep it there for the same amount of time there that we have our money with them, because if they should ever lose our money, we want to be able to grab that collateral and make sure we're not out anything. And the collateral requirement, I believe, is 110%. So banks actually have to spend money to hold on to our money, but that's all required to keep things safe.
So we're talking about places like, let's say, Wells Fargo, Bank of America in that case.
It depends on the banks we're dealing with. We tend to look at which banks we think are safest, and those are listed in our monthly report.
Okay. So that leads, of course, to the next question. There's been a lot of discussion for a number of years about San Francisco creating its own municipal bank.
Right.
Can you tell us why that might be something that's attractive for San Francisco to do? And what are some of the reasons why people would favor that over, let's say, using a commercial bank?
Mm-hmm. So for the last 10 plus years, I would say people have come up to me personally and expressed a lot of interest in some sort of a government bank, a municipal bank, state bank. The only one that exists right now, I think, is the state of North Dakota. So it's a state level bank. And I completely understand where this interest comes from, because certainly I am very eyes open and have actually been quite vocal around a lot of these largest banks, what many people like to refer to as Wall Street banks. They're not always doing things that are in the best interest of their customers. And certainly probably the most egregious example of this is the big Wells Fargo scandal that we saw a few years ago with the unauthorized and fraudulent account openings, which, by the way, resulted in Wells Fargo not only creating these fraudulent accounts, but through the course of having fees for those fraudulent accounts be withdrawing funds from their own customers' valid accounts, they ended up actually stealing money from thousands of their customers to the tune of millions of dollars. I mean, talk about egregious. The bank's the one place we put our money to keep it safe, and we can't even trust that they won't steal the money from us. So I completely understand. I've been very vocal in my calling out of bad behaviors by Wells and by many other banks that have not taken their customers' best interest at heart. And so I understand ever since the age of Occupy, where there's been a lot of interest in the considering of looking at a municipal bank. I was very excited that almost 2 years ago now, the mayor and the Board of Supervisors actually passed a resolution asking our office to do a report, a study on what it might take to create a municipal bank. We did that by gathering up a task force of many of the most passionate supporters of the concept, a lot of people with real life experience in running a bank, even building a bank, from government folks that are involved in monitoring banks, people from all across the state of California, even out nationwide, joined our task force. They met for 6 months. I think they did a tremendous job where they put out a report that is the most informative report I've seen to date that talks about what it would take to stand up some sort of a government bank. Again, credit the task force. We actually came up with a couple of different scenarios. One would be kind of a full-fledged all-in bank, something similar to the biggest Wall Street banks that would really be able to fulfill all the city's banking needs. And another, maybe a kind of a smaller, leaner financial institution, but whose mission was to kind of alleviate some of the unanswered needs that are out there in the marketplace. Small businesses that can't get loans when they need them, when they're just starting out. Homeowners who are facing foreclosure. Low-income folks that are being ripped off by payday lenders and the like. On and on and on.
People who can't open accounts because they don't have valid ID.
All that type of thing. Student loan alternatives or refinancing opportunities. So certainly that would be a smaller and leaner venture, would be less costly and shorter timeline than the standing up a full Wall Street-sized bank. But we were honored to be able to have the group come together, put that information together, and that is what we make available to the policymakers. Neither me nor anybody in our office is going to make the decision about how the city spends its money.
Where do you stand on the issue?
That's always... where the city spends its money and what it decides to do is absolutely the job of the policymakers that you and I vote into office in our city, the mayor and the board of supes. So in my job, I purposely stay neutral on these things, both whether the city should build its own bank or whether there should be more taxes, fewer taxes, new taxes, whatever. The one thing we've found over the years is it's really important for people to trust that we're unbiased as we administer and enforce everything that goes on. So we want to make sure that people know we're unbiased.
But do you have an opinion?
I think that the facts should go to the Board of Supervisors and the mayor, and they will decide. The same way they decide whether there should be a new bus route or there should be a new hospital and all that. I officially stay neutral.
You won't tell me. Well, that's a good moment to pause and reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight our guest is San Francisco City and County Treasurer and Tax Collector Jose Cisneros. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Have you been helped by one of the city's financial empowerment programs, which we're going to talk about more in a few moments? Do you have a question about how taxes are collected in this city? The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using the handle cityvisionsKALW. So I wanted to turn a little bit now towards the things that I didn't know, to be honest, that you did as treasurer and tax collector, which had to do more with financial equity, mm-hmm. which is a very hot topic these days and has been for years in this city and across this country as the wealth gap and income gap continues to widen. You launched the Financial Justice Project in 2016. How did it come to be?
That's a great question, and I'm very proud of the work we've been doing with the Financial Justice Project. Let me just give you a little history, and then I'll talk about the Financial Justice Project. Since I've been treasurer, we've done a number of what we call financial empowerment projects, financial empowerment programs. These are programs that just help low-income people be more successful with their funds. One of the things we found was that in our city, like in most every city, there's a good-sized portion, unfortunately, of low-income families and households that don't have even a checking account. When someone doesn't have a checking account, they have nowhere to go with every one of their paychecks to a check cashier. So you take all your paychecks to a check cashier, the fees you'll pay will add up to $500, maybe $600 or more dollars per year. It's heartbreaking to think about a low-income family paying that type of fees when they could have just had a checking account. So we launched a program to connect people to bank accounts. We've launched other programs to actually match up one-on-one financial coaches with low-income families to help them do things that will make their financial situation better, pay down their debt, increase their savings, get a bank account if they don't have one. And by doing all those things, which we've now done for thousands of folks in the city, you do those things and lo and behold, the credit score goes up, sometimes quite dramatically, or people go from having no credit score to having a decent credit score. These are the kinds of things that can make a huge difference, especially for someone who's low income and living close to the edge. We knew that was important, and we've rolled out a number of programs to do that. But then the age of Ferguson and all these impacts of, you know, cities getting engaged and unpaid fines and fees and debts being treated as kind of criminal and getting people arrested or having their driver's license suspended or, you know, oh my gosh, getting put in jail or worse, right? So we really wanted to take a look at, you know, where are our own government fines and fees impacting people in a way that's not fair? And what we actually put together another task force in 2016 that took a look at this, and they met for 6 months, and they again listened to the community. We had members of the various city departments and the courts and everybody else in the conversation, and what became very clear is that the reality in our city and county and all across the country is that whenever there's a fine or a fee that's one size fits all.
Regressive.
Exactly. There's no surprise that that's going to impact a low-income person or family far differently than a middle-income or certainly a high-income individual. And so we took that, and the Financial Justice Project has looked at that, and here's some of the things we found. You know, a lot of these fines and fees in San Francisco are very costly. Parking tickets can go to $200 or more. If you get your car towed in San Francisco, even going immediately and picking it up the same day, close to $500 to retrieve your car from a towed car. Things like that are oftentimes completely out of reach for a low-income family. So what we were learning was that a low-income family whose car gets towed couldn't afford to get it back. If they can't get their car back, does now one of the working adults not able to get to his or her job? If they can't get to their job, they're not going to get paid. If they don't get paid, will they not be able to pay their rent? Who would have ever thought that the offense of having your car parked in the wrong place and getting it towed should lead to, you know, impacting a family's income or even getting them kicked out of their home? And so we started looking at unintended consequences. And what it really brought us to was, you know, if we could right-size these fines and fees as much as possible so that they would come closer to impacting people more or less equally, that would be a better way of administering them and doing them in a way that if there deserve to be consequences for something any of us do, there should still be consequences. But let's make sure that they're more or less equal in the way that they hit people. So just in this example of those parking tickets and towed car fees, I'm excited that we've worked in partnership with the MTA that administers a lot of those, and they've worked with other city departments. And we've now implemented a process by which a truly low-income person, someone receiving food stamps or other types of public benefits, can easily verify that, and then their parking ticket or their car tow, the amount gets cut in half, and makes it far more affordable. Now you might think, well, of course, if we cut the amount in half, the city's going to get less revenue. Yes, sometimes that is the case. But we actually found in some of these situations, particularly around the MTA fees, that in some cases, the city actually brought in more revenue because people want to do the right thing. If they can afford it, they want to pay it. And by collecting more, we actually brought in more revenue. So that's the kind of things we're looking at in the Financial Justice Project. We're looking at driver's license suspensions. It seems like it's overboard to suspend someone's driver's license just because they have an unpaid ticket or fine or fee or something like that. It's mixing apples and oranges in some ways, and it's certainly bringing unintended consequences. We looked at some incredible fees that actually didn't make sense at all once you took a close look at them. We, like every county across the country, had actual fees that were placed on people who were just coming out of prison. In San Francisco, in San Francisco, people coming out but having to go on probation would likely be on probation for as much as 3 years. In San Francisco, the fee that we were charging for that, for the privilege of being on probation, was $50 a month. 3 years of that, we gave a person just coming out of jail a bill for $1,800 and said, please pay us for your next 3 years of probation. Please pay us up front. Well, this person's just been in jail. Very unlikely they have $1,800 hanging around to pay us for, and over 90% of those bills never got paid, which is one reality. But the other probably more upsetting reality was that all those unpaid bills that we gave to those people went onto their record. And so when they went to apply for a job, when they went to put in an application for an apartment, it actually started to become a roadblock to them getting their life back together. Now, that just doesn't make sense. We brought all of this knowledge for the fees around probation, around ankle bracelet monitors, all that stuff, to our local government, to those same policymakers. And we said, you got to question whether this makes sense. San Francisco became the first county in the country to eliminate all those criminal justice fees. And so no one would have to face those types of bills going forward. But it also to help the people who've been suffering under those bad debt records for years. They erased all the debts, the millions of dollars owed by 23,000 individuals who showed those on their debts.
What motivated you personally to do this work?
I think that all of us, particularly when we see, as you mentioned earlier, the lives being impacted by the cost of living, when we see the income gap growing as incredibly wide as it's gone today, when we see how people struggle, particularly low-income people, but even what in a lot of other places might be very middle-income people, struggle to survive in an expensive city like our own, I certainly don't want to see them be preyed upon by check cashers or or payday lenders, but I also don't want them to suffer from an unfair system that's even being created and administered by the local government or the courts. And I'm really passionate about saying everybody deserves a fair chance. Everybody deserves all the best information and the best tools to be financially successful for them and their family. And I think that's part of the responsibility of us in government to see if we can do that.
And given the fact that a lot of this falls on people of color, and you being a person in government that is a person of color, how much was that important to you to do for that reason?
Well, I'll be honest. When I became treasurer, one of the first things I did was I came from a background of out of college. I was a banker for a number of years. After that, I was in the corporate world. I was with a tech company and eventually IBM for quite a while. So I certainly knew, you know, how people were successful and how people successfully managed their money. One of the first things I did when I was appointed treasurer by then Mayor Gavin Newsom was I partnered with him to roll out a program to increase the uptake of a great federal benefit called the Earned Income Tax Credit, money that is available to all the working poor individuals and families in this country. And our goal was to take a credit like that that's largely undersubscribed to get more people in San Francisco to claim it so they could be successful for their families. It really opened my eyes to how challenging it is and how difficult it is to be low income and to not have the information. And if you think about it, think about this. What does government do? We use our voice to help people be more successful. The police department sends out messages, lock your doors at night. The fire department says, check your smoke detectors. The health department says, you know, pay attention to nutrition. Why not have the treasurer say, pay attention to your money, keep your money safe, don't get ripped off. Here's how the best practices are, how they make people successful, and how can we help you and your family be financially successful?
I want to put the number out again in case you want to join our conversation this evening on City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org with our guest tonight, San Francisco City and County Treasurer Jose Cisneros. That number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-TALK. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org. Post a comment to the KLW website or our Facebook page, and you can also tweet us at City Visions, KALW. So that's really important about, you know, government not being part of the problem, but being part of the solution. So I wanted to go back to something that you touched on very briefly, which is talking about the, I think, things that fall under maybe the Office of Financial Empowerment, mm-hmm. which is really helping people build their own financial literacy. How well known are these programs? How do people find out about them? What does it take to access these types of services?
Great question. Thank you for asking, by the way. Thanks, Joseph. We do everything we can to make sure that people know there are resources out there. One of the very first programs we launched was the program that was meant to tackle the problem I brought up earlier, which is somebody who doesn't even have a bank account, has nowhere to go but these rip-off check cashers. Entirely legal, by the way. I'm not saying they're doing anything illegal. There are absolutely far lower-cost alternatives and safer alternatives than going to a check cashier and keeping all your finances in cash. When we launched that program now back in 2006, we partnered with every single partner we could find across the city and county. We reached out to community groups. We talked to churches, synagogues, mosques, everybody we could find, union labor leadership, everybody we could talk to help us find a way to get the word out. And the whole point was we had put together this website, we put together this program called Bank on San Francisco that said, you know, we really wanted to deliver people that they could, too, have a bank account, they could keep their money safe, and they could do it at a far lower cost. And the website served to connect them to a bank or credit union close to where they live or where they work. And so we were very excited that in the first year of the program, 10,000 folks moved from being unbanked to banked as tallied up by the banks and credit unions we had partnered with who were opening up accounts. to date, and that we still have that program to this very day, and to date we estimate close to 75,000 folks in San Francisco have moved from being unbanked to banked. They're keeping their money safe in a safe financial institution, and they're paying far lower fees than they would have paid at a check casher. I'm excited about how we've been able to make a difference there. And actually, the federal government now does a national survey of a rate of unbanked, and in San Francisco, our rate has dropped dramatically, and we're very proud of that we've been able to do that here in San Francisco. But that's just the beginning. Having a bank account is just step one. I mean, there's far more, things we all need to be savvy about and mindful about in terms of being financially successful. One of the most important things is saving for an important financial life goal. And now, if for some people that goal is being able to pay for their kid to go to college. For other people, it's being able to buy their first home. For some people, it's even saying, I want to start my own business. I want to really be, you know, my own boss and the driver of my own success. But don't, you're not going to achieve any of those things if you don't have a thoughtful savings plan, a disciplined budget, an ability to, you know, to track and monitor and follow all those things. And so while getting a bank account is an important first step, it's merely a first step. So we've had programs now that we help people build towards those assets. Probably one of the most exciting programs that I'd love to talk to you about is one we did to help kids in our city. There's research that shows if a child grows up with a college savings account in the child's name, engaging with that account, the kids seeing their parents make deposits in that account, builds aspirations over the course of that kid's childhood. And that child is many times more likely to go to college and complete college compared to if they didn't have those aspiration-building experiences as they grew up. That just makes sense, I think, to all of us. But the hard, cold reality is a lot of kids, particularly kids in low-income families, their parents never get around to opening up a college savings account for them. So they're growing up, you know.
Or just can't.
Or, right.
Literally can't, right?
Right. If they don't have a checking account for themselves, it's hardly likely they're going to go to the next level and open up a college savings account for their son or daughter. And so we reached out to the best, leading thought experts in the country. We got the best thinking about how you might put a program like that together. And we launched the first of its kind program that we call Kindergarten to College. We partnered with the public school district, which is a high percentage kids from low-income families. And we said, we want to do it, and we're going to use all the best methods and practices that the experts have experimented and landed on, which is it should be automatic and universal, an account for every kid and every kid and automatically no paperwork, no parent signatures, nothing. So we opened up an account for every incoming kindergartner in the public school district. 4,500 kids start school each year in kindergarten. Excuse me. And we open up an account for each one, making sure that they start off their school career with a college savings account. Hmm. The research shows if we can get their parents and maybe someday, you know, a high school kid to make deposits of their own, again, it just builds this college-going identity and mindset in their head. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
And the city contributes to that account?
The city puts the opening deposit of $50 in each and every one of those accounts. And we also provide small cash incentives to get families to begin saving and continue to regularly save. I'm very proud of the fact that to date we've opened 33,000 accounts for kids in our public school district. The oldest account holders have this year entered ninth grade. And the families are beginning to save. Nearly one out of every four of the accounts that we've opened had the parents have started to save, and the parents have saved over $4 million of their own money for their kids' college education, and this is mostly parents of low-income families. So I'm excited to see that we're hopefully making a difference in these kids' futures, and I think it's something that they deserve.
And what happens if the student leaves the school district?
All good questions. So if Once a student or their family starts saving in the account, we don't care if they stay in the school district or not. We've got money they want to save for college. They're engaged with the account. We want to have them be successful. So we'll keep that account open until they save the money and then use it for any educational purpose after high school.
So it has to be educational, though?
Yes.
Okay.
It has to be, but not necessarily college. It could be vocational school. It could be a computer. It could be books, whatever. Whatever makes sense for the student. If a family has never engaged with the account and then they leave the city and or the school district, we figure they may not even know it exists. So we'll close that account, take that $50, and distribute it to other kids who will be engaged with the account.
And what kind of – how is this money invested?
So we partnered with a bank, a local bank. We did an RFP process, and Citibank was the bank that we worked on since we launched the program. They actually have opened those 33,000 accounts and administer them. And any family that wants to make a deposit, they can make a deposit online. They can send a check through the mail, or they can, it's as simple as walking into a Citibank branch, going up to a teller window, handing over a check or cash, and making a deposit in their kid's college savings account. All the monies that go into those accounts actually immediately become the property of the city and county of San Francisco, because we're very clear that all these children's accounts are actually sub-accounts to the city's custodial account. Since the money is then owned by us, we work with the bank and we make sure it's invested well.
Okay. So I wanted to turn to a couple of other things just that are perhaps different from what we've been talking about so far. But related. You've talked a lot about how you are, you know, passionate about this work that you're doing, not only to make sure that the city stays financially sound, but that its citizens are able to be financially savvy. And so sounds like that's something that you've dedicated a lot of your time to. So there's a controversy that's come out recently. Mm-hmm. Article about you in SF Weekly ran a story about your travels and trips that you've taken that have been funded by a nonprofit called Cities for Financial Empowerment Fund. And the contention is that this nonprofit, whose board you sit on, is funded largely by banks and corporate institutions, for example, Visa and American Express, and that these types of banks, for example, may have an opposition to the city's interest in creating a municipal bank. So how do you reconcile the work you do as treasurer and tax collector and needing to follow city policy and this work that you do for a nonprofit that may not necessarily match?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking it. I'm very proud of the work we've done to help low-income people in this city. We've launched a number of different programs from the Bank on San Francisco program that I talked about earlier to as well the Children's Savings Account program, kindergarten to college. Many of the programs, those two in particular, have actually been replicated in many other cities and governments across the country. Because of the success of those programs and the interest that comes from national organizations, other cities and governments, Governing Magazine, which was nice enough to put me in their magazine a few years back in recognition of much of this good work. I'm many times invited to speak at different conferences, to even travel to other geographies, to other cities, to share our work with them so they can look at doing some similar things in their area. San Francisco has actually become a national leader in this area of municipal financial empowerment, and I'm very proud of the good we've been able to do here and the model and example we've been able to set for cities across the country. We actually early on created a coalition of cities. It's now grown to over a dozen different cities nationwide that are heavily engaged in this work. We come together a couple of times a year. We trade best practices. We continue to find new ways that we can help the citizens in our community. And it was actually that coalition that wanted to see that work be more effectively spread to other places that caused us to create this nonprofit, which was the Cities for Financial Empowerment Fund, which largely gathers up donations and then uses those funds to spread this same work to more geographies and more cities and more locations across the country.
But how do you respond to the criticism that there's this conflict of interest?
Sure. So that nonprofit does fundraising and gets funds from wherever they can to continue to spread this work. I do sit on their board, but I'm not a practitioner. I don't have anything to do with the day-to-day running. I don't raise the funds for that organization, and I don't administer them and give them out. There's no surprise that when it comes to matters of financial empowerment and financial education, some of the corporations that understand that the best are corporations that happen to be in the same industry. So whether it's large commercial banks, other types of financial institutions, they're the ones that see the need most directly. And for that and maybe other reasons, they're the ones that have at times donated, as well as other foundations and other types of funders have worked with this organization. What they do, how they behave, and what they might stand for or vote for or against has absolutely no bearing on me individually or me as a board member or the work of that organization. It's completely separate. I've never had a meeting where we've even discussed with that group things like the municipal bank and all that. So in my mind, they are completely separate and apart. And again, as we talked about earlier, when we created the Municipal Bank Task Force and put out a very comprehensive and high-quality report, I'm proud of that work. I know that it'll be very helpful in helping steer the conversation for our policymakers as the city and county looks at and decides, you know, what do we want to do of anything of this type.
So let's move to the fact that you're running for a fourth term in this job, and as far as I'm aware, no one's opposing you at this point. What do you hope to accomplish of the things that you have already started? Where'd you like to see them go next in a next term for you? Or what are things that you'd hope perhaps to launch that you haven't had a chance to do yet?
That's a great question. Thank you, Joseph. I am passionate about what I get to do in the treasurer's office and with the team that we have there that does really great work. I started out this evening talking about how much we work to make sure that the taxpayers pay what they owe, comply with the laws, but also have the most in-depth understanding, knowledge, and accessibility to how they interact with our office. We're going to continue to improve our practices and make it even easier and more customer-friendly for our taxpayers to engage with our office and do everything that they're owed. This might make you smile. Our largest revenue source, our property tax collections, are still to this day operating on a 1960s era IBM mainframe computer.
I'm more like cringing,
yeah,
not smiling.
Yeah. It's a little surprising. I will say that mainframe computer is rock solid. It never fails, but it is hardly modern and adaptable and flexible and something that's easy for us to, you know, continue to deliver better customer service. So I'm proud to say we are almost midway through a replacement project that will move us to an entirely modern property tax collection system that we and the controller's office will use to be able to deliver even more and better service. These are multi-million dollar capital investments that take many years for the city to be able to afford to do. I've been there 15 years, and we've known we needed to do it, and we're finally doing it now. But that's the kind of thing that I'm passionate about. That's the right thing for us to be doing. It's the right thing for us to figure out how we can be more efficient, more productive, and more successful for our taxpayers, who, again, as I mentioned earlier, are largely businesses. One of the taxes and laws we enforce is business registration. Everybody that runs a business in this city has to come to our office and register their business. Large to the very smallest. And the very smallest is a one-person business, namely an independent contractor who's in business for themselves, isn't an employee, and they come and register as well. So those 100,000 businesses are majority very small and even somewhat small businesses. We know as well as anybody how much of this city runs on the success of our small and even medium-sized businesses. We want to make sure we're doing everything to make them successful. I talked earlier about consolidating the bills so we're not surprising them every week and every month through the course of the year with new bills. We will continue to find ways to make it easier for taxpayers and businesses and individuals to work with our city laws, our taxes and fees, and make sure we're doing everything we can to make businesses successful, because those businesses provide the jobs that people that live here, you know, work at. They pay the salaries that hopefully allow people to be able to afford to live here and to have housing and pay their bills and all that. So we see ourselves as having a key role in that success. Mm-hmm.
Do you see a municipal bank opening up in your next term?
I leave that to the policymakers like the mayor and the Board of Supes. You know, it would certainly be exciting. I'm guessing we'd be one of the first. But again, you know, folks need to think and sit down and think about, is that the right thing to be done at a city level? Should it be done at a state level, like the state of North Dakota, like the one that's in existence right now? You know, what would be the goal of it? Is it just to help people, or is it to completely replace the Wall Street banks for our government and many others? So there's a lot of questions to be answered. There's a lot of serious costs that come along with it. That is what the folks that decide our $12 billion budget each year, those are the folks that have the responsibility for making that decision. But I'm excited to work with them going forward and see what they decide.
And then what about in the financial justice and financial literacy side of things? What do you see coming up next?
Thank you. We're excited about the success we've had with the coaching model. One of the programs we've put in place is we actually have picked up a model that was launched initially in some other cities where we actually will take a low-income individual or family and connect them to a one-on-one financial coach so they can get very individualized custom advice on how they can be more successful. And we want to make sure we're doing that for everybody that needs that help in the city, and making them be as successful as possible. As we continue to roll that out, we're looking at things where we can help them with maybe some different types of emergency monies. There's a shocking statistic that shows that close to half of all the households in this country could not put their hands on $400 or $500 if they needed it in an emergency. And that's what drives them to things like payday lenders, who will rip them off to the tune of, you know, closer to $1,000 as they try and repay that small borrowing. So we want to make sure we're doing everything we can to help people be successful financially. And I think there's still a lot of work to do.
And finally, how has it been being out as a politician? How has it influenced your career, and how has it influenced the work that you do?
Well, as an openly gay elected official here in San Francisco, I'm very proud of the fact that I'm not the first. We've had a number of them for many years here in San Francisco, and I'm proud to stand on the shoulders and the records of a lot of out men and women, and even some trans individuals who've been around the same time as me or preceded me. I think it's important for all of us to present and to be present for our communities and to represent our communities. I think everybody in our city and across the country and across the world needs to see that all different types of people can be successful, can deliver on their mission, their goal, can live their values while still being an important role, whether it be in government or private industry or anywhere else. And I've been honored to be able to have this position for as many years as I have, and I want to continue to do a good job and really be able to make a real change for the folks that live here, and be it as a proud, open Latino individual here in San Francisco.
Great. Well, I want to thank you, City and County Treasurer Jose Cisneros, for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Grace Swan. Join me next week as we talk about San Francisco's budget. Why does it take $12 billion to run our city and county? We'll find out next week. This is Joseph Pache. Until then, good night and have a great week.